Okay, well, thank you. So I guess everybody knows about inner core anisotropy, so I won't go into details, but I think because I'm not going to talk about anisotropy, I just want to make sure I said a few words about it, since it's, if you talk about the inner core, that's sort of the central problem, which is that seismic waves that travel along polar paths travel faster by a few seconds than waves that travel on equatorial paths. And this has been interpreted for now more than 20 years as an indication of anisotropy in the inner core. But in fact, I'm going to discuss, I have a whole list of topics, but I want to go through this one, and maybe if I have time, I might also talk about the hemispherical variations at the top of the inner core. So I chose this topic because it might be relevant to, or interesting to, the dynamo community. For this, to study the basically the shape and corrugations on the inner core, outer core boundary, we use a pair of waves, the PKP DF or PK large IKP, which penetrates into the inner core, and then a reflection at the inner core boundary, which we will be looking at post-critical distances, this specific distance range where the reflection is post-critical. So what do we know about the inner core boundary from seismological observations? We know that it's pretty spherical. If you look at trying to determine the radius of the inner core in different locations using reflected waves, they come out pretty consistent from different places. There's been initial attempts, for example, to interpret the faster travel times of PKP DF along polar paths than equatorial poles as indicating an oblate shape of the inner core, but that would require a really strong oblateness, like a couple of hundred kilometers, which is not dynamically sustainable. So then, for the same reasons, long wavelength topography is rather unlikely. It hasn't been observed seismically, and it's rather unlikely from dynamic considerations. On the other hand, there are small-scale lateral variations that have been attributed to the vicinity of the inner core boundary. For example, significant coda in the reflected wave that indicates that there is some complexity at short wavelengths. There's also evidence from various types of study, in particular array studies, for scattering at the presence of significant scattering at the top of the inner core. And there's been some recent studies, in particular this study by Krasnoshchekov and others, that have seen some variability at lateral scales of 10 to 200 kilometers that they've attributed to some patchiness in the texture of the top of the inner core. They were, however, looking at reflected waves before the post-critical distance, so in that case, it's kind of difficult to interpret exactly where the loss or not loss of energy is coming from. So for this study, we used doublets. So what are earthquake doublets? Earthquake doublets are two earthquakes that have occurred in very similar locations and separated in time by some years. In this particular example, it's 10 years. Two earthquakes almost identical in size and location, and the way they are kind of identified is that the waveforms for the two earthquakes are extremely similar at many locations. So this particular very, very excellent doublet was first found by a study in Zhang et al., where they were focusing on constraining the rate of differential rotation of the inner core. But the doublet, and you may or may not agree with their conclusions, here they're showing a time variability in the arrival time of the PKPDF compared to the BC phase, which travels in the outer core during these 10 years. But the doublet itself is really excellent, as I will show. And so we've used the data from this doublet in the South Sandwich Islands observed at the Yellowknife Array, which is a small array, well, small in aperture in Canada, which happens to be at this distance from these events, which is a post-critical distance for PK little IKP, and also very favorable in terms of radiation. This is the radiation down the P wave radiation in the direction of the core phases that is observed at Yellowknife, which is right in the lobe. So there's a sort of the best kind of configuration possible for the study. How good that doublet is indicated by looking at waves traveling in the mantle, such as PP, observed here over the Yellowknife array. At the bottom is the stack over, I think, 18 stations of the array. And you can only barely see here that we're actually superposing two traces, a blue trace corresponding to the 1993 event and the red trace corresponding to the 2003 event. And for a rather long time period, like here 40 seconds, around the PP, you can see that the traces are practically identical. There's very, very little change in the main PP and even in its coda. So these are really very similar events. This is sort of a close-up. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, yes. I mean, much of this is coda of some kind. But at that level, it is very, it's amazing, actually. Amazingly similar. So this is, again, a close-up. So you can see there, I mean, it's not completely identical. Here you can see a little bit of a difference, but it's very good. If you look in different frequency bands, this is 0.5 to 1 hertz, very similar. 1 to 2 hertz, that's a little bit breaking down, but it's still the main phase is pretty similar, and things start breaking up at higher frequencies. So the frequency range around 1 hertz is quite favorable. And so now we're looking at this pair of phases that interact with the inner core. So the DF phases that penetrate slightly into the inner core, and the reflected phases here, indicated by CD, and the waveforms for all the stations of the array in 1993, and this is for 2003. And you can see just by naked eye that while the waveform of the first phase, the refracted phase in the inner core, DF, are similar, there is a lot of difference in this reflected phase. If you look at this more in filtered between 1 and 2 hertz, it's even more clear that you have a lot of difference, at least in the amplitude between these two events, much larger difference in this reflected phase than in the DF phase. This is a close-up of the stacked phases, which been done here is that the PK little IKP has been flipped upside down because there's a phase shift because of the reflection on the, compared to the refracted phase. And so if you compare the waveforms look very similar between these two phases. There is a defect, there is much less amplitude in the reflected phase of the 1993 event. In fact, you can compute the amplitude ratios between the DF and little IKP for one event and for the other. They're very different. And if you filter between 1 and 2 hertz, the ratio of the amplitudes of the reflected phases is a factor of 7. So it's a huge difference. The question then is, you know, which one is anomalous? What is anomalous? Is it the reflected phases? Is it the DF phases? And which event? It's most likely that there are some issues here with the reflected phase because the DF are only slightly different, reflecting the slight difference in magnitude of the event. But there are, you know, more quantitative ways to assess this. If you look at the amplitude ratios of DF to reflected phase for the 2003 and 1993 event, and I've used up the batteries, so you can see that if you compute the theoretical amplitude ratios for different 1D models given here, and the realistic inner core Q factor, you get something which is quite close to the 2003 amplitude ratio, whereas the 1993 one is way out there. It's not even, you get close to it, but you have to assume an infinite Q alpha in the inner core. So this is an indication that it's the 1993 reflected phase amplitudes that are anomalous. So now you have to look at what the possible reasons are. There might be some differences in the source time functions. We rule that out because of all the work that has been done on this doublet and the similarities of observations everywhere. We've ruled out presence of local regional telecyclic perturbing events on one of the cases and not the other. The paths through the upper mantle of those two phases are really extremely close. They really only differ in the core and near the inner core boundary. So the heterogeneity in the mantle is unlikely, but there could still be some small-scale scattered phases that we cannot see directly. And so we did some wavelet analysis here, shown here, using three different wavelets, shown on the left here. And the analysis here in terms of amplitudes and in terms of phases. And you can see that there's quite a lot of difference in the amplitudes. But if you look at the phases, these are isophases corresponding to the zero crossing for each of these wavelet types and the two events. And they really track each other very, very, very closely. So basically, the observation is that we have an amplitude anomaly, but practically no observable phase anomaly. So this indicates to us, and there's also other evidence, there's no departure from the great circle that is observed. Since we have an array, we can look at slowness and azimuth of space, and everything is coming from the great circle path with expected slownesses very closely. So no significant departures from great circle path. Differential travel times, I didn't talk about this, but they're very small also, less than 0.1 second for DF and 0.05 seconds for PK. Little like AP, no phase anomalies seen from the wavelet analysis. And very large amplitude differences, which come primarily from the 93 event. So this is really a strong indication that the effect is some kind of focusing, defocusing, or attenuation by some kind of heterogeneity near the ICB reflection point of the 1993 reflected phase. So there's two possibilities, an attenuating layer at the top of the inner core that would be laterally varying, or a bump on the inner core boundary. And we favor the latter for the following reason, is that if you look at the reflection coefficient of the reflected phase and look at, for example, a patchy model such as Krasnov-Chekhov, and look at the variation of the reflection coefficient if you're in the solid patch or a liquid patch in his model, and also compared to prem, you see that at the distance, post-critical distance we're looking at, there's really not much difference in the reflection coefficient for any of these models. And so this kind of lateral variations, which would be an attenuation, lateral variation at small scale, is basically ruled out. So this leaves topography on the inner core boundary, and so can we characterize it better? If you look now at the spectrum of the amplitudes of the reflected phases, the 2003, which is larger and more quote-unquote normal, and then the 1993, the most of the energy loss is in this period band or frequency band 1 to 2 hertz. So this gives us an indication of the sort of lateral extent of the bump. So it, you know, gives us sort of a lateral extent of the order of 10, 15 kilometers. We have an upper bound on the height of the bump because we're not observing very strong, or we're not observing any significant travel time anomalies or travel time differences between these two. And so this gives us a height, sort of an upper bound on the height of about 3 to 5 kilometers, but we don't really need that high a bump to see a focusing effect. If you do sort of modeling of reflected wave amplitudes and presence of topography, an aspect ratio of 0.02 is sufficient. So those bumps may be as small, you know, maybe a lateral extent of 10 kilometers, but it could be as small as 300 to 500 meters, so less than a kilometer. So then, you know, so we have bumps on the inner core boundary, which one of the events sees, another doesn't. So how might that be possible? You know, one possibility, of course, is to invoke a sort of attractive possibility is to invoke a differential inner core rotation. And in 1993, you would be the reflection point would be on a bump, and so you would be defocusing energy. This is the incoming and then the reflected energy. And then by the time 2003 comes, inner core has rotated off the bump and you are seeing a normal amplitude. And we have other observations of doublets that are not as perfect but are pretty good, for which we see somewhat different kind of behavior. Here is a doublet separated only by 2 years, and both of the reflected waves are actually large and relatively normal. And here's another doublet separated by 8 years, in which both of them are anomalous. And because of the slightly different location of these three doublets now that we're looking at, the previous one, the best one, 9303, and these others, we can put some bounds. You know, given a wavelength of the topography, we can put some bounds on the inner core rotation rate that would satisfy all of these observations, and we get a rotation rate of about 0.12 to 0.15 degrees per year, which I think is... It's a map of the bounce point at the inner core boundary of the three. And 1 degree here is then 21 kilometers. So I'm sparing you the details of how we got to that constraint on the, but it's basically looking at the, you know, how topography might be, sort of periodic topography might be shifted. And you get this kind of minimum constraint. Of course, there's another possibility, which is time variable topography. You see a bump in 93, you don't see it in 2003. But that would imply very rapid changes at the inner core boundary, which I think is not very realistic. Because if the inner core could grow that fast, it would have grown. It would have filled up the inner core a long time ago. So, so the first possibility makes much more sense to us. So concluding this, you know, we're seeing decadal scale variations in the amplitude of the reflected phase, which indicate time-varying processes at the inner core boundary. which are constrained, as I mentioned, about 10 kilometers laterally and perhaps less than a kilometer vertically, would be compatible with a very small differential rotation rate on the inner core. This also puts constraints on the viscosity of the inner core, which has to be large enough to sustain such bumps, whichever interpretation. And it accounts for a lot of observations, the variability in, or seismological observations, the variability in the DF coda seen by some authors, the coda observations of the reflected phase, variability at subcritical distances, which was interpreted in terms of patches, but it could equally well be interpreted in terms of topography, and then other observations such as changes in the envelope of the PKPDF phase. And since we wrote this paper, if you kind of establish that there is short wavelength variations in the topography of the inner core boundary using doublets, you can now go and look for amplitude ratio anomalies, but not necessarily look at doublets. So we've scanned, 10 years of data so far to see where we see anomalous amplitude ratios and where not. For example, I was interested in seeing whether we could, for example, see the degree one sort of pattern that is seen in a lot of observations of the top of the inner core. But so far, the distribution of quote-unquote normal amplitude ratios versus anomalous is pretty, there's no pattern in it. But this is sort of preliminary. We may kind of refine this and find something. But so far, this is more negative. So it seems like there are bumps everywhere. And I should mention that there was a study by Wen et al. That was published almost simultaneously as our study. Ours was a bit late. We submitted into Science 2 weeks after Wen submitted theirs. Very similar. They're using the same doublet. And their conclusions are very similar, except that they're using travel times, differential travel times, whereas we're using amplitudes. And I think the amplitude observation is so huge. Whereas the travel times are much more subtle that they're looking at. They're also looking globally rather than at an array. So that's the one topic. And I don't know if people have any questions before I move on to the Yes, completely, yes. You still overlap. Yes. I think the Fresnel-Zon argument is not a very strong one, I guess. You still overlap, okay. There are lobes, yes. So, I haven't really looked at this very carefully, but I'm not sure, these are differential measurements, so even, Fresnel's own argument may not be completely useful for that kind of thing. Right, you could refine. You could probably refine that. Yes, we stacked the data. Yes, maybe I didn't make that. I didn't make that. So. Yeah, I guess I guess you do introduce a small slope, but yeah, I mean you could probably, but I think, you know, if you're talking about focusing effects, this isn't something you would necessarily be able to kind of resolve exactly. But yeah. Well, that's, well, we did that here, you know, showing. This is telling us that that there are no significant departures from the great Silver Path, and so you're basically and the way I'm thinking about it is that the wave kind of sees the whole bump, you know, kind of doesn't, you can't really say which point on the bump you're at. You're kind of averaging over the whole bump when you're on the bump, and then when you're off the bump, you don't see it. But, yeah. I mean, it is a little bit anomalous, but it's not. It's not a very significant, you know. I mean, yes, I mean, if you look, start looking at it in great detail, you do have here, perhaps, you know, well, I guess you have 2 degrees, right? Difference. The shape. Mm-hmm. Wait, so, I mean, that's, I guess that's, I mean, that's not incompatible with the fact that you're you know, sensing a topographical high. Right, I mean, I guess it's in the same direction as most of the personological studies. So great. No, you couldn't explain all of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, because that's where the reflection coefficient. That would be the statue model. But when you're at post-critical distances, you're not very sensitive to that. Yes. They were looking. Yes, they were looking at scattering. Yeah, they were looking inside, in the core, at larger distances. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes, that's right. But this was looking at larger distances inside the inner core. There are different types of data. Well, I think it has to be larger in 10 to the 16th or something, to 16, yes, but of course you could have some small scale convection at the top of the inner core, so 60%. Do you want to hear about the natural variations in attenuation and top of the inner core? So this has to do with the observations that first, with some observations that were very intriguing and first reported by Tanaka and Hamaguchi in the context of the study of inner core anisotropy. In which they observed that for polar paths, using this BC minus DF, so the differential travel times, which assuming that there's nothing in the outer core, most of the effect would be due to the inner core, on these polar paths, depending on where the sampling of the inner core is, whether it's in the so-called Western Hemisphere, or in the Eastern Hemisphere, they get very different, much smaller anomalies in the Eastern Hemisphere than in the Western Hemisphere. So this was sampling the inner core in the depth range of 80 to 200 kilometers, something like that. From this first observation, this has been confirmed many times. This is just from a paper I wrote a couple of years ago using a global data set of BC minus DF data. You can see in red the, as a function of the angle of the path in the inner core with respect to the rotation axis, you can see the red are the Western Hemisphere triangles and the green diamonds are for the Eastern Hemisphere. And you really don't need much anisotropy to explain the Eastern Hemisphere observations are much more rest. So these are comparing different models, a model by Shure and Toy 91 requiring 0.62% anisotropy in the inner core to explain the Eastern Hemisphere data, which of course in the data more scatter. And in the West, the Song 1996, 2.8%. So there's this difference, and here is a model of Krieger that tried to model the whole thing with different structures in the Western and the Eastern Hemisphere. And so people have kind of proposed this kind of models inside the inner core to explain the differences, with anisotropy being sort of inside the inner core, but there would be an isotropic layer which would have different thicknesses in the Western and in Eastern Hemisphere. So I'm going to really be talking about attenuation. So I put this slide to kind of remind people about what we know about attenuation in the inner core, mostly from body waves. The body waves measure Q alpha, Q of compressional waves, and in a paper by Sohyun and Udil, they determined that it was increasing with depth. So topmost 100 kilometers was about Q of 200 and twice as much below. More recently, Li and Cormier determined an average inner core Q alpha of about 307 plus or minus 90, but they also found that there's much stronger attenuation at the top of the inner core, so consistent with this on average. They also found in a recent study by Komi and Stushkova that there is a change in the magnitude and variance of the attenuation around 400 to 600 kilometers depth in the inner core, so there's some kind of layering. If you look at these results and if you assume that there is no frequency dependence and no significant attenuation in bulk, then you can convert the Q alpha into an estimated Q for shear waves, and you would obtain a Q for shear waves of about 40. Low compared to what is observed from free oscillations, for example, PREM, has a qubit of 85. There's another model, Scripps model by Widmer and others, which has 110. And there have been a number of papers in the literature that have suggested even much larger qubits in the inner core from free oscillation data, but they've kind of been contested in terms of how they've been determined. There was a paper by Foucault and others using a so-called Sumpy method, which I think has been determining a Q of over 1,000, in the Q beta over 1,000. But anyway, and we had an observation of PKJKP from which we tried to determine, put some bounds on the corresponding Q beta and found that it should be larger than 150, but this would be compatible with the free oscillation observations simply if you introduce an increase of Q with depth, because the PKJKP samples the center of the inner core, whereas the modes sort of have less sensitivity to the center, more sensitivity to the outer part of the inner core. So in any case, whatever the values you prefer, there is a little bit of incompatibility between Q alpha and Q beta, which implies either frequency dependence or some attenuation in bulk in the inner core. We've been looking again at this pair of phases, pk little IKP and pk big IKP, at post-critical distances, to look at these. So these hemispherical variations have been documented first in travel times, and they've been documented on the basis of this type of observations, also by several other studies, New and Wen, and then Garcia and Sohio, I think in the last 5 years. They've all seen this very this hemispherical pattern, even at the very top of the inner core. And if you look at these two phases, which travel so closely everywhere else in the Earth, it's really hard to imagine that such strong variations, hemispherical variations, could really be due to anything else than the vicinity of the inner core boundary. But anyway, so we decided to look at this on our own, and so we collected the data set. This is just some examples of data. You see first the PKPDF and then the PK little IKP. These data were collected for deep earthquakes, so the source time functions are short. The idea is that you want to have a collection where the two phases are well separated enough that you can actually compute amplitude ratios. We had a number of criteria for waveform similarity, noise levels, etc., to collect this data set. And there were narrowband filters on 1 hertz. And we confirmed the travel time differences between this eastern and western hemisphere here, about up to 1 second difference, which is very clear over the whole distance range that we looked at. But we also measured the attenuation from amplitude ratios, and you actually see the same effect in the attenuation, except that it seems from our data set that this difference kind of disappears at around 140 to 143 degrees. That is primarily at the shorter distances, that is, which would correspond at more shallow depths of penetration of the DF phase in the inner core. So we, if you look at the comparisons here, you have high Q in the western hemisphere corresponding to what this would correspond to, low velocities in the inner core, and the opposite for the eastern hemisphere. And from the point of view of attenuation, you start with very large attenuation in the outer core, and so there has to be some kind of transition. It may be abrupt, of course, at the inner core boundary. We don't know, because we are sampling only starting to about 30 kilometers depth. And it seems like we need, in the eastern hemisphere, you kind of drop down to somewhere at the ICB, and then Q increases regularly towards depth. And whereas in the western hemisphere, you have a decrease, and basically things kind of become more or less indistinguishable between the two hemispheres. And so these are the values that we measured, and they're compatible with some of other studies, but incompatible with Wen and Yu's measurements, who find Q values which are factor of three higher. So anyway, the idea here is that you could have lateral variations in attenuation if you invoke some model like that of Sumida and Olson, where what is imposed on the co-mantle boundary, the heat flux on the co-mantle boundary would impose some temperature, slight temperature differences on the inner core boundary, and so you would then have a possibility of a different hemispherical differences at the top of the inner core, and in the way the solidification would have slightly different character in the western and the eastern hemisphere. So basically, to summarize, we do see hemispherical vacation attenuation at the top of the inner core, in addition to velocity. The western and eastern hemisphere have different behavior, and that's probably related to how different melt fractions and different connectivity of liquid inclusions in the western and eastern hemisphere due to temperature differences at the inner core boundary. Other studies have confirmed these differences in attenuation. This is a study by Yu and Wen. But now what's compatible is that they see the differences between west and east. Granted, data are very scattered, but these are noticed amplitudes not of the reflected phase, but it's PK-PDF, referred to PK-PDC. And so they're looking at larger distances. And so they claim that the differences in attenuation actually continue to at least 200 kilometers depth. On the other hand, and these are some of the waveforms that they base their study on. For eastern hemisphere on the top, for western hemisphere on the bottom, the left are data of the inner core penetrated phase. And they also had some PK, little IKP, I guess. What I showed before was for BC, but they also had the reflected phase. And you can see that there are some differences in the waveforms and the separation between these two phases that they model with different both velocity and attenuation models. But their values here are very, very different from ours. So that's the one difference. It may be that our distribution of data was not sufficient for Q. For example, at the large distances, we don't see much difference in the Q values, but we also have our data selection has removed a number of, has ended up with very few paths. So maybe we don't have enough global coverage to see that at the larger distances. On the other hand, Pushkova and Cormier also had a study where they looked at the hemispherical variations, and they again confirmed the differences in travel time here between the reflected and the differential travel times between the reflected and the refracted phase. So this is really very well established. And they also identified a sort of a portion here in the eastern. Is this the eastern or the western hemisphere? I get confused always. A sort of anomalous region where they see some complexity in the waveform. But they see some actual secondary reflections. But in their paper, they conclude that this anomalous region is shallow, that it does not extend much greater depths than 100 kilometers, which would be consistent with our results. So there's still some things that are not quite settled, but there's clearly some hemispherical variations at the very top of the inner core that may indicate what I would call presence of lateral variations in the mushy zone. This time we would call it the mushy zone, because it is beneath the inner core boundary. So, that's it. We haven't gone that far. there's been a study by Singh, who has tried to model this kind of mass, and I seem to remember that the values you get in were sort of more compatible with the values you were getting, basically going from 100 to 300. So, but I can't really claim that we've done that very yes. Well, you're limited by the coverage, right? So, for example, here, this is the coverage we have for the bounce points of the reflected phase. So you probably can't see the colors, but this is green and this is yellow. So you see you see some consistency across a large area, whether it's exactly degree one or Cormier, like this. Yes, yes. I mean, this is sort of. There are some regions that are hard to obtain coverage for this type of weight, because you need specific distances. I think the variability with it, so for example, if you just look at a function of longitude, you see that in this region, they are pretty consistent wherever you are, right? But you're not completely covering everything. If you add, this is just for the reflected phases. If you add the sort of deeper penetrating PK, this is the distance range which corresponds to very top, 25 to 80 kilometers within the inner core. But if you add the BC reference phases, then you go down to 200 kilometers, and then you have better coverage. And it really is very much hemispherical. I have some slides somewhere else that shows how well, there's even a sort of a relatively sharp transition from one to the other in the C minus BF travel time. I don't think this is, you can't say it's really degree one, but it's a large region. You can say it's a large region. Yeah. No, this is actually on my computer. It's a projector issue. The scale is probably unfortunate, but all of this is green, and all of this is yellow. The stars are the event locations, and the squares are the stations. And then the symbols are plotted at the reflection point. Mm-hmm. Maybe. I mean, it's, right. Or completely eliminating the qualities. Yeah, right. Yes. I mean, but it, I was not, until we worked on this, I was not convinced that this hemispherical or quasi-hemispherical pattern would necessarily be in the inner core, you know. It could be some corrections that haven't been done right in the mantle, but it's really, really very hard to put this in the mantle, given, you know, how close these two waves are everywhere. Well, you could also explain it by a different connectivity in the match between the Western and the Eastern Hemisphere, where I guess if you have a mush that's very well connected, you would, I think, get slower velocities. And in regions where it's where you have a matrix, much more solid matrix, you would have faster velocities. So it's compatible. I mean, the observations are compatible. No, within the inner core, because yes, it's not the slurry, it's the mush. So this is a plot from this paper by Yu and Wen showing different models. I'm sorry, this is not very clear. I did what I could from the PDF I had, but so this is the inner core, and this is the discussion we had the other day, right? And now we're talking about what goes on here. And this is Prem, and you know, the models that at least they did do have a different ingredient at the top of the inner core between the Eastern and the Western Hemisphere. So the Western Hemisphere has a steeper gradient to explain. Which on average, I guess, you know, on average you get something like Prem. Yes, well, that's what I said is that they have this, you know, their interpretation is that it goes to very large depths. Somewhere in here, the model is indicated, you can't really make it out, but they have several models that they are plotting here. This E1, E2, which are their models. ECR is, I guess, our model, Sara and Romanovich, and I can't remember what is what, but they're practically indistinguishable. Prem is here, I think. Prem is black. No, Prem is the gray line, and the different other models are up here. And you can see a little bit of, you can see some broken line here. So they're not very well distinguishable. in my opinion. E1 is this one, yes, the thick, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, this is really thin. Right. Yeah. So I'm not sure about these models. I'm showing them here because of the point you made about the tinted gradient. Is that whether it or not they're exactly why they need this here, I'm not sure. But I guess the point is you can have different gradients at the top of the inner core, the top 100 kilometers or 150, and still get an average that is very much like 10. Well, yeah, I mean, how deep you can go, I don't know, but I mean, it's clear that below, everybody would agree that the hemispherical variations, whether you refer to them as anisotropic or not, because people will argue about whether this is, anisotropic or not, but definitely, below 400 kilometers, you don't see these variation, so that would put an upper bound or a lower bound on how deep you would have. Well, actually, yes, but this has been the South and Central Alaska are these ones here. So you have all of this is not South and Central. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, in fact, if you look at this curve, as I like to point out, you don't see a smooth, you know, increase like in the standard, you know, simple anisotropy model. You really see something pretty flat and then something pretty anomalous there. You know. So, yes, you're right to point out that the South Sandwich to Alaska Pass are particularly anomalous, but there are other polar paths that are also very anomalous, but the, you know, the trend is more flat and then up than a smooth kind of a parabolic trend. Any of the yes, well, that's why I was interested in looking at you know, a global data set to see if you could debunk of different types in the West and in the East. But so far, we haven't, you know, this and this. You've got both anomalous and, of course, as I say, this is rough and preliminary because now, you know, when you have a doublet, you can really you know, rule out a lot of other possible causes. Now here, these are data, you know, for single earthquakes, so you could have amplitude anomaly due to stuff in the mantle or, you know, something else. We're just kind of assuming that that there is topography in the inner core boundary and that it's dominant effect based on our previous study, but we have to kind of refine it to be sure. But there is, a priori, I was very surprised, because I was expecting that we would be able to connect this to the hemispherical variations and that we would see some difference. You would have to change it in an oblate fashion. And if I remember correctly, and Adam, you can correct me, but I thought it was a couple hundred kilometers you needed, like over 100 kilometers. Yeah, well, it is. I mean, if the radius is 1,200 kilometers, that's 10%. Yes. Yeah. So 1,000. Yeah, 2 kilometers. The 2 kilometers in terms of travel time anomaly, we can calculate that by delta t. Yeah, it would be the travel time anomaly, which would be not be. Plus, it's a big difference. I mean,
it's quite a big difference.
As I say, well, I think it was more than 100 kilometers. I mean, we can compute that, right?
Yeah.
Because we get 2 seconds, right?
You know, the contour velocity from point eight out of ten.
Well, 5%. Yeah. 0.8 over 10 times 10, L equals 2 seconds, so L equals 200. Yeah, so 200, you get 200 minutes. I was right. We would get a degree one.
L1, M1.
Well, necessary L1, yeah, M1. Yes. Right. Well, I mean, if again the I think the figure, this figure here is perhaps the most. Whoops. Well, I, if you want, I can dig out some figures showing. It would take longer to find. I wanted to find the. I had some plots of the. And I. Yeah, French edition. Okay. This one. This is from the work by Ishi and Device. So if you look here and here, you see this is the angle with respect to the rotation axis. You see a large difference. What's the difference between these two? But this is like deep, it's already deep in the 200, at least 200.
Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid too, what the distance there. But I think the one up there is the physical distance, which is sort of under 200 kilometers.
Right, so this would
very
this
much.
So the point is, you have differences here between Western and Eastern, right? And you can see the. All the way out. And again, it depends where you are, you know, at what depth you are, because we're talking about, here we're talking about, as I said, 200 kilometers. What I was showing was really much shallower, 15, 32. There are more points here. This is IHC bulletin. You couldn't do what we did with this data set. Well, normal modes are sensitive to first order only to the even degree heterogeneity. Through coupling, you know, with heterogeneity, you could extract some odd degree, but I don't think you'd have to use modes that are close by that would have the right difference in angular order and the turnout. So far that hasn't been possible. It's not clear that we can really get that kind of information from normal modes. You lose degree one. Yes, I was looking for a figure, but I don't think I have it. I didn't show all the slides. I always have like a bunch of supporting. This one has, I mean, if you wanted, I could talk about the density jump at the inner core boundary. But since Dave isn't here, maybe it's not. Okay? Yes. Yes. Something like that.